This is your community radio station, 88.3 Southern FM.
Right now is the space show. Welcome to the Space Show, presented by members of the Space Association of Australia. Hello, I'm Andrew Rennie, and on the panel we have, in Mission Control, Richard. And that sound you heard, we're going to talk about it, but it wasn't good. So our topic this evening is Starship. Is it Elon Musk's visionary dream or his nightmare folly? So, first up, we have Space Show News. SpaceX is a United States company founded by Elon Musk. Its main activities include the Falcon 9 rocket, the Dragon and Crew Dragon spacecraft, and the launch and operation of thousands of Starlink communications satellites. For the past several years, SpaceX has been building and testing the world's largest rocket system. It has two stages, the Heavy Booster and the Starship. Now, Starship is a combined rocket and spaceship. Its purpose is multifold. First, to place thousands of Starlink satellites into orbit with each launch. Secondly, to land humans on the moon as part of NASA's Artemis program. Third, to act as a refueling tanker for other starships. Fourthly, to transport cargo and humans to the surface of, guess where? Yes, Mars. That fourth use is our main topic of discussion on this evening's The Space Show. But first, to what happened last Saturday, Australian time, at Boca Chica in Texas. A Starship, that's the spacecraft, not the Heavy Booster, was being loaded with methane fuel and liquid oxygen oxidizer in preparation for a test firing of its engines, of which there are six. Before we listen to the commentary from the enthusiast group at NSF, we should explain one term which has become a joke since it was first used several years ago by a SpaceX employee. It is RUD. No, not Kevin 07 RUD. RUD is for Rapid Unscheduled Disassembly. What you and I would call an explosion that blasts a rocket to smithereens. We pick up the NSF commentary as the clock ticks past 11 p.m. Texas time.
Real question is, if everything goes well here for this static fire, when launch? Let's go around the table of what we think. Max, you first.
I'm not sure. They could push it if they really wanted to. So assuming the fire goes well and they review data and they're happy with it, no engine swap needed, they go back into Mega Bay 2, finish up the heat shield tiles, and then roll it out to the launch site after they roll Booster 16 out of Mega Bay 2, or Mega Bay 1, I should say. I could see before the end of the month. So I think in less than 2 weeks, they could, assuming all goes well tonight.
But I think it's going to be a couple days after that, personally. I think we're going to see it just before the July 4th holiday would be my guess.
God, although, like, it has to be said, a July 4th launch would slap so hard. That would be so cool.
Yeah, now granted, if they do a six-engine static fire tonight and one of the engines eats itself and then they have to roll it back to the production site and swap out an engine and then do another static fire, all bets are off. But assuming tonight goes well, six-engine static fire goes well, we, again, don't know if it's going to be long duration or short duration or what, So stay tuned, because you that's part of the fun of tank watching, right? Is we don't know what's about to happen. We just assume there's going to be some sort of engine test, likely a six engine. But if we're making assumptions and we assume that that test is going to happen tonight and goes well, yeah, I mean, I think a launch right at the end of June is completely plausible the way all of the pieces are lining up on the chessboard.
Continuing to watch here as the fuel load is underway for the Ship 36 static fire, of which we are hoping that this will be the full six-engine static fire, given that we saw the single-engine static fire earlier this week already. I believe that was on Monday, so just a couple days ago. The question is, do we think this will be a short duration or a long duration?
That's just the nature of this testing, right? Like, SpaceX doesn't tell us what they're doing. They don't put out an announcement like, on this time, at this day, we're going to do a six-engine. Like, we just don't know. But I really do hope that it's six engines for a nice long duration. It's not every day they do a static fire test at night, especially not a long duration one. So hopefully, if that's what happens, we end up getting some super cool views of, like, flames shooting out of the flame trench. That'd be sick.
Again, as we reach the 11 o'clock hour here at Starbase, we are waiting for Ship 36 to perform its second static fire test of the week.
I mean, even the other day when they... Whoa!
Whoa!
What?
That's no! Not good.
Oh my god.
It appears there has been a
Ship 36 just blew up. Ship 36 just blew up. It just blew up.
So about those launch dates, I think that may delay a bit, as we've just experienced a RUD of Ship 36 prior to a planned static fire test at the Massey's test site in Starbase, Texas. You can still hear some of the popping. The screen went completely white there with that.
Oh my god, I'm shaking.
What?
That was the craziest thing I've ever seen. The stuff is still cooking off at Massey's. I don't even...
So, yeah, if you get a chance to try and explain what it looked like and what it sounded like from out in the field.
I mean, I just looked up and saw bright white. I'm sorry, the exposure on the camera was toast. That was... What?
That's
I mean, stuff's cooking off. Can you guys hear that? Things are cooking off at Massey's right now.
Yeah.
Let's listen for a bit. You could still hear things popping, it sounds like. Is that what you're talking about, Jack?
Yeah, it just sounds like pop, pop, pop. It's a loud rumbling, and in fact, yeah. I can see the plume sort of illuminating in conjunction with that sound. I can see some debris falling, it looks like, some flaming debris. I hope we don't get any kind of wildfire. I hope everybody is okay. I mean, that's why they clear out Massey's, and wherever they're doing any tests, that's why they have a blast danger area, and that's why they clear it out. That is so many questions at this point. What on Earth just happened? This is not bode well for the Starship program, and I mean, of course, SpaceX will pick up the pieces and figure out what went wrong, but very clearly a huge, hugely catastrophic anomaly, a huge setback for the Starship program. I mean, how are they going to test any ships? How are they going to cryo any boosters? How are they going to do anything at Massey's? This is not good. This is so not good.
And it's worth noting, the fire there is still burning. This is still a very active situation there after that explosion. Not just, as you pointed out, the destruction of the ship, but based off of the sounds of what we can see that looks like damage to the Massey's test site, which right now is the only place capable of testing those ships.
I mean,
you can still hear the popping.
If we can go back and just remember...
I'm still hearing things cook off. I'm worried about all the propellant tanks and everything. I mean, there could be more explosions coming shortly here as things continue to burn.
Most important, Jack, D, Caesar, Jerry, please be safe out there. If you need to get off and move, let us know.
Not only was the Starship totally destroyed, but much of the test stand infrastructure was demolished. As the NSF commentators noted, this is a great setback to SpaceX's plans for Starship.
Another one bites the dust, and another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey, hey, I'm gonna get you too. Another one bites the dust.
Now, while SpaceX is building the world's largest rocket, dozens of entrepreneurs are building small rockets. The most successful is New Zealand's Rocket Lab, which has launched more than 60 of its Electron rockets into orbit. The pioneer in small rockets in the 1960s was Chance Vought's Scout, which was used by both NASA and the United States military for launch of small satellites. This NASA space story from 1989, yes, 1989, tells the story of the since-retired Scout.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration presents The Space Story.
Of course, after the Sputnik, the Soviet Union put everybody into the space business. And there was a need for a small class expendable launch vehicle. Langley started design work in 1958, late 57 and 58. And in 1960, the first launch occurred from Wallops Island.
The diminutive Scout rocket may not make headlines like America's other launch vehicles, but for nearly 30 years, it's been a dependable and relatively inexpensive way to shoot small payloads into space. Like other expendable boosters, Scout is a one-shot rocket designed to launch satellites that don't require the presence of astronauts. John Van Cleve of NASA's Langley Research Center describes the type of spacecraft that qualifies for a ride aboard Scout.
It's limited by weight and volume. They have to be able to fit inside our heat shield, so 40 inches in diameter and about 3 feet long. And weight we can put, it depends on the orbit they want. When Scout was first developed back in the early 60s, we could put about 130 pounds in a 300 nautical mile orbit. We can now handle 450.
Over the years, Scout has orbited satellites for NASA, the Defense Department, and several European nations, and in the process has become one of the world's most reliable rockets. But it wasn't always that way. Van Cleve recalls how the Scout team literally had to start over from scratch after half the booster's first 14 missions failed.
We went through all the vehicles, tore the vehicles that existed at that time back down to basic components, inspected them for workmanship, and reworked them to the new standards. So we essentially recertified all those Scout vehicles. And the first flight of the recertified vehicles happened in 1963. And since then, we have flown 89 missions, and there have been 85 successes. So we're 96% since the recertification program in 1963.
Scout uses solid rocket motors in each of its four stages and is steered by a relatively uncomplicated, pre-programmed guidance system. Simplicity, says Van Cleve, is one of the things that has made Scout so successful.
When NASA developed the Scout, they used off-the-shelf hardware. We've had investigation teams investigate the Scout program to make sure that you have no problems, like after the Challenger accident. And when they look at us, you a lot of times get spacecraft people, and they can't believe that you use off-the-shelf hardware, that you don't use, you know, high-rel or high-reliability parts.
In addition to its role as a satellite launcher, the versatile Scout has also carried out many important scientific and technological tasks for NASA.
One of the missions we flew was some material that was later used for the Apollo heat shield. It's the one where that you blast it out and then you blast it back in the atmosphere so that you can check out the heating on the spacecraft that re-entered the atmosphere, etc. And we've had like 12 re-entry missions. And I think we've had like 10 successes out of 12.
Under our new space policies, NASA will buy launch services from commercial companies rather than purchasing rockets like Scout directly. In a way, it's the end of an era, but one that Van Cleef says the people at Langley can look back on proudly.
The Scout has a type of esprit de corps, a loyalty. Today, you can talk to some of the people that were on the Scout in the early phases, and they're still pro-Scout people. Just talk to some of them that retired, and they wish they'd have never retired. You can look back at all of the things that we did in recertification and all the procedures and all that, but it's really the people that make the program.
This has been The Space Story, a space and aeronautics report brought to you by this station and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration.
And this station is 88.3 Southern FM, and the show you're listening to is The Space Show. That story from 1989. Now, in 1980, that's 9 years before this story, I actually visited the Scout Launch Center and went through the control room and all the electronics to support the Scout rocket. Quite an interesting visit at Vandenberg Air Force Base. Now, back to Starship and SpaceX. And Social Chords, early in January, released this song called SpaceX Starship Flight 7. Let's take a listen.
Well, success is uncertain, but entertainment is guaranteed. Super Heavy has been caught for the second time. Go, SpaceX! NASA has this phrase that they like. Failure is not an option, but failure has to be an option in art and in exploration because it's a leap of faith. And no important endeavor that required innovation was done without risk. You have to be willing to take those risks. So that's the thought I would leave you with, is that in whatever you're doing, failure is an option, but fear is an option. But fear is not enough.
Starship is the first rocket design where success in making life multiplanetary is in the set of possible outcomes. Mechazilla has caught the super heavy booster.
You're listening to 88.3 Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
Where you're listening to The Space Show. Now, as serendipity would have it, we here at The Space Show had, in late May, prepared a documentary feature on Starship and had scheduled it for broadcast on this very evening's program. So here now is that feature.
Starship. We're so high. Let's do this.
Elon Musk has long had an interest in human spaceflight to Mars. A decade ago, his company, SpaceX, had developed the Dragon spaceship as an unmanned cargo resupply for the International Space Station. Then came Crew Dragon to ferry astronauts to and from the space station. At the time, Musk floated the totally unrealistic proposal to send experiments to Mars on a modified Dragon spacecraft, the so-called Red Dragon. That concept was explained to a meeting of the Space Association of Australia in 2016 by the late David Wilson, who then was Vice President of the Mars Society Australia and a research and development engineer at the Ames Research Centre in Mountain View, California. Well, and you can hear that talk if you visit the Space Show's website, which is space.southernfm.com.au, and go to the list of people who've been on the show and go to David Wilson, and you'll find his talk there. Now, Red Dragon, of course, fell victim to the realities of engineering and funding. Now, in late May, Elon Musk spoke to a gathering of his disciples at Starbase in Texas and explained his current vision of getting humans to Mars and setting up an extraterrestrial civilization. The plan is based around the use of the Starship that SpaceX is currently test flying. Here's Elon.
But you need a big rocket, you know, to, you know, make life multiplanetary. So in terms of when can you go to Mars? So you can go to Mars every 2 years or every 26 months. So the next Mars opportunity is at the end of next year in about 18 months. So November, December is the next Mars opportunity. So we'll try to make that opportunity if we get lucky. I think we'll probably have a 50-50 chance right now because we've got to figure out orbital refilling in order to have enough capability to go to Mars. But if we achieve orbital refilling in time, then we will launch the first uncrewed Starship to Mars at the end of next year. So. So this gives you an illustration of how does a spaceship go from Earth to Mars. So you got blue Earth there and red Mars. And I mean the actual distance traveled on the arc is close to it like 1,000 times further than the moon. So you can't just go straight to Mars. You have to create this elliptical orbit with Earth at one point and Mars at the other side at the far end of the ellipse, and then time the where you are in that ellipse to intersect with Mars. And this is the orbital transfer, how you do orbital transfer from Earth to Mars. And if you look on your Starlink Wi-Fi router, you'll see this image, because the Starlink Wi-Fi is Starlink Internet is what's being used to pay for humanity getting to Mars. So I'd just like to thank everyone out there who's bought Starlink, because you're helping secure the future of civilization and helping make life multiplanetary and helping make humanity a space-faring civilization. Thank you. So this is a tentative game plan here where we're hoping to achieve, where we increase the cadence of flights to Mars dramatically with every launch window. So every roughly 2 years, we are dramatically increasing the number of ships that go to Mars. And ultimately try to get to 1,000 or 2,000 ships per Mars rendezvous. I mean, as a rough order of magnitude, this is just guesses, obviously, but we need to get about a million tons, is my guess, to the surface of Mars to make a civilization on Mars self-sustaining. And getting to that critical point where if the resupply ships from Earth stop coming for any reason, Mars still succeeds. Mars can still grow. And so you can't be missing anything. You can't be missing even like the equivalent of vitamin C or anything. You've got to have everything you need for Mars to grow. That's essential. So my guess is that's about 1 million tons, but it might be 10 million tons. I hope it's not 100 million tons. That'd be a lot. But we want to try to get to that point and secure the future of civilization as quickly as possible. So we're looking at different locations. The lead candidate right now is the Arcadia region. Now, Mars has a lot of real estate, but when you combine all of the factors and say, okay, we can't be too close to the poles. We need to be near ice to get water. Can't be too mountainous for the rockets. It narrows down to a smaller region. So Arcadia is it's one of my daughter's name is Arcadia, actually, and is one of the options. So we got the first starships on Mars, gather critical data. So the first flights there we'll send with the Optimus robot, so we can go out there and explore and kind of prepare the way for humans. That'll be a very cool image if we're able to achieve it by launching end of next year. It would actually technically arrive in 2027, but that would be an epic picture to see Optimus walking around on the surface of Mars. And then with the launching 2 years later, we'd be sending humans. Assuming the first missions are successful and they land successfully, we'd send humans on the next mission, and we'd really start building the infrastructure for Mars. So, anyway, maybe just to be safe, we might just do two landing episodes with the Optimus and do the third one with humans. We'll see. And then for communications on Mars, we'll be using a version of Starlink to provide internet on Mars. It's quite challenging to do high bandwidth communications with Mars, but Starlink will achieve that. Yeah, and then we'll have the first humans lay the groundwork for permanent presence on the surface. And yeah, the goal, like I said, will be to make Mars self-sustaining as quickly as possible. And we want to get to the point where we're transferring over 1 million tons at every Mars transfer window. And then that's like a serious civilization. 1 megaton per transfer window. Because of the fact that you can't fly there continuously and you have to transfer in these windows, you'd have a gathering of 1,000 ships or 2,000 ships or more than that. So we have this kind of like Battlestar Galactica feel where all these ships are in orbit waiting to depart, and then they'd all depart. And then you're going to need, obviously, a lot of launch pads, a lot of landing pads on Mars, or you'll need to move the ships off the landing pad pretty fast. So if you've got a few thousand ships inbound, probably need at least a few hundred pads, landing pads. And anyway, we'll solve that problem later. Yeah, anyway, this is like an incredible thing to have, like this amazing city on Mars, the first city on another planet, a new world. And it's also an opportunity to, I think, for the Martians to rethink how they want civilization to be. So you can maybe rethink, like, what kind of form of government do you want? What new rules do you want to have? There's a lot of freedom and opportunity in Mars to do a recompile on civilization, which will be up to the Martians. Let's get it done. Thank you, everyone.
Elon Musk speaking at Starbase in Boca Chica, which is right near the border with Mexico on the Gulf of Mexico. To summarize, here is Elon Musk's plan. Next year, 2026, send 5 unmanned Starship landers to Mars, each with 10 tons of equipment. The aim would be to demonstrate key technologies. At the 2028 and 29 launch opportunity, send 20 landers with 75 tons payload per starship. The goal, to land initial infrastructure, confirm resource availability, to prepare landing areas, and deliver equipment that would be needed by humans on future missions. A humanoid robot would be tested on the first of these missions and humans on the later ones. During the 2030 to 2031 launch window, 100 landers, each with 150 tons of cargo, would be sent to Mars. The goals would be fourfold. Firstly, to carry out resource mining and propellant generation. Secondly, to build roads and launch pads. Thirdly, to construct human habitats. And fourthly, to increase power generation and storage. In 2033, Musk would have 500 starships arrive on Mars, each delivering 300 tons of materials. The major goal would be to increase independence from Earth by mining and processing Mars resources. My reaction, as I heard of Musk's ambition...
Tell him he's dreaming.
Yeah.
He was dreaming.
That was a quote from the Australian movie The Castle, with Michael Carton playing Daryl Kerrigan. And Bill Nye, the science guy, agrees with Daryl.
I'm Bill Nye. I'm CEO of the Planetary Society. And then as far as this idea of settling Mars, I just don't think anybody's going to do it. A concern is the same thing that makes a place on Mars interesting to explore, to get mud rock samples from, and so on, could be the same wide open place where you'd want to try your first landing. So you do not want to contaminate the interesting places with your human stuff. Start with that. Start with really either proving that there is nothing anywhere alive on Mars and never was, or find something that is alive on Mars. And then as far as this idea of settling Mars, I just don't think anybody's going to do it. Nobody settles Antarctica.
Yeah.
It's cold, inhospitable, nothing to eat, really. And you can breathe, which is key. If you go to Mars, you will find very quickly that you can't breathe. That's a real drawback.
A real drawback. Another advocate for going to Mars is Robert Zubrin. He also thinks that Elon Musk is dreaming. This is what he said on May the 28th this year.
I want to talk about how to make the Mars Initiative a success. We have a unique, potentially generational opportunity right now to get a Humans to Mars program actually started. But the question is whether it will be carried off successfully. That is the reason why we have an opportunity to get it started, and a very good opportunity. I would think the chances are actually quite high right now that we will get a Humans to Mars program started, is because Elon Musk has achieved a position of tremendous influence within the current administration and has gotten them, as Trump has said in his inaugural address, he's going to send humans to Mars, and they are rapidly moving on developing the Starship, which creates a technical foundation, or no, not. It creates a good part of the technical foundation needed to send humans to Mars. However, there's a lot of problems with this program as it's currently conceived. And in fact, I believe as it's currently conceived, it will fail. And in order for this program to succeed, it has to be put on the right political, intellectual, and technical basis. And so I am going to address all three of those points. Now, as I said, the political basis to start the program actually exists. But Musk has defined himself in a hyper-partisan fashion. And by the way, not just here, but internationally. And if this program is conceived of and remain conceived of as a Musk hobby horse, it will fail. It will be destroyed as soon as the fortunes of political war shift, which could occur as soon as next fall. And to some degree are certain to change after Trump leaves office in 2028. So this thing has got to be changed from a Musk program into, at minimum, an American program, okay? And better would be a free world program that helps pull together the nations of the free world. I do not believe at this point that a fully international program of all the nations together is a realistic proposal. But I do believe that if it, with proper leadership, this could be made a program that pulls together and is participated in by all the nations of the Western Alliance. However, at a minimum, it has to become an American program, not a Trump must program. And I want to be very clear about this, because there's a lot of people out there, maybe not so much in this room, but a lot of people are listening to this out on the internet, who think that Musk can do this all by himself, and we don't need NASA, this is all going to be done by good old Elon. Okay, that's not happening. Okay, it's not happening for a number of reasons. Okay, because while Musk is developing, and of course yesterday's flight was not fully successful, but they're making incremental progress, and I think it's a fair bet that Starship will reach orbit this year. Okay, but he is developing the single most important element of the Mars mission. There's many other elements that need to be developed. All the surface systems, including, as noted, surface power. And my calculation is that to execute the Starship mission as Musk has defined it, it needs at least 600 kilowatts of surface power, which has got to be nuclear. It's 12 football fields of solar arrays, and they'd be unreliable because they'd have no power in a dust storm. And it's got to be a nuke, and to develop nuclear power requires government involvement, because space nuclear reactors involve highly enriched uranium-235 or else plutonium. These are tightly controlled materials. That's a government job. And many other things that need to be developed, like surface spacesuits, surface vehicles, the ISRU equipment itself, one could go down the list, while they could be developed privately, won't be, because a launch system has a commercial basis outside of the space program, and it can be developed commercially. But Mars surface systems right now really don't have a commercial basis. It's a job for the government. So this needs to be a public-private partnership. And beyond that, there are so many things about this mission that even if Musk could develop all the technology, requires a favorable government environment. Because, for example, existing planetary protection rules could be interpreted by those hostile to the program to simply forbid it. Okay, existing planetary protection rules would rule out landing humans on Mars, full stop. Okay, you actually have to have the U.S. government, at a minimum, wanting to do this, and foreign governments not want to intervene against Musk. And, well, in other words, we want to have this be an American program. We want everybody on board. All right, now, this gets us to the intellectual basis of the program. Musk describes his program as an effort to create a city on Mars which will allow humans to survive after the Earth is destroyed. Okay, now he gets this. His intellectual basis for this comes from the Isaac Asimov Foundation trilogy, which, if you haven't read, it's a great read. I'm all for Isaac Asimov, but it's wrong as the basis of a Humans to Mars program. Now, in that trilogy, what happens is there's this grand galactic empire, and this one scientist, Harry Seldon, realizes that it's going to collapse, and so he gets together a bunch of scientists and put them on a planet called Terminus at the far edge of the galaxy, and they're to be there to reemerge and reestablish human civilization after the galactic empire collapses. That's the plot line of Foundation. And this is where Musk is coming from, and he even calls his proposed Mars city Terminus. Okay, now, this is a false basis for a Humans to Mars program. It's false technically because, first of all, a Mars city of a million people could not survive as an autarky. Frankly, the United States can't survive as an autarky. That's why the stock market crashes every time Trump says he's going to try doing it. But certainly a million-person city would not have the division of labor and technology required to manufacture all the things to sustain a modern technological civilization. The artifacts that you have are created by a worldwide division of labor of 8 billion people. And absolutely could not be created in a city of a million. So a Mars city, and I believe there will be cities on Mars, and I think initially the cities on Mars will be tens of thousands, not millions. There were a couple of million person cities on Earth, like Rome and million-person cities were not common on Earth until there were railroads, because you need long-distance transport to bring together the materials needed to sustain a million people in one place. But in any case, the technical basis isn't there. But in addition, the rationale is repugnant. Okay, we are not going to Mars to desert the Earth. Okay, we are going to Mars in order to establish, I mean, when we go to settle, okay, which follows exploration, but if we're talking about the issue of settlement, we're doing it to establish new branches of human civilization which will add their creative capacity to that of humanity as a whole, expanding our ability to deal with challenges of all types, including, yes, extraterrestrial challenges like asteroid impacts, but also all sorts of technical challenges. America, as a new branch of Western civilization, invented, you know, steamboats and telegraphs and centrally generated electrical power and light bulbs and airplanes and nuclear power and computers and the internet and iPhones. And the same Mars could be a great creative addition to human civilization, and that's why it's important for humans to settle Mars. But going there to hide, okay, going there out of despair, we're not going to Mars out of despair, we're going to Mars out of hope, okay? And, you know, rather than the people there being viewed as like the heroes of Foundation, be more like the protagonists of Edgar Allan Poe's story, The Mask of the Red Death, who go into a castle to party while everybody outside dies of a plague. Okay, so this is not what it is. Okay, now, while, as I said, the goal of Mars settlement is to create, is to expand the capacity of humanity to deal with all challenges.
Robert Zubrin of the Mars Society, speaking in Washington at the 2025 Humans to the Moon and Mars Summit Conference. More from Zubrin after these messages.
Southern FM.
The sounds of the Bayside.
And now we return to Robert Zubrin and his thoughts on Elon Musk's Starship program.
The immediate goal that I believe can get buy-in, that can make this program bipartisan, is science, okay? Because human explorers on Mars and the heavy lift and heavy payload delivery capability that is a necessary precondition for humans to Mars could be an enormous boon for science, as I've said. And see, look, right now, with this program being pushed at the same time that this administration is pushing on killing NASA's space science program, in particular, essentially zeroing the Mars science exploration program, because they're canceling sample return, but not proposing to replace it with anything else. I mean, there is a valid case for replacing sample return with, you know, 20 smaller exploration missions, landing rovers and helicopters and things all over the place. You can make that argument, but just canceling it and having nothing, that's a disaster. And basically, they would be putting the mark of Cain on the Humans to Mars program, as it would be seen as not merely a must thing, but a must thing that murdered American space science. Okay, so it would be dead. Instead, we have to make this program be seen not as the enemy of space science, but as the welcome best friend that space science ever had. And I will explain how that can be done. Now, I'm going to get a little bit into the technology. The Starship plan, direct flight to Mars, direct return from Mars, is a variant of the Mars Direct plan, which I first laid out in Case for Mars and some papers that preceded it back in the 90s. However, instead of coming back in a relatively small Earth return vehicle, which required a 100 kilowatt reactor, the Starship is much bigger and require at least 600 kilowatts of power. Okay, and that's a big challenge. Now, I also should mention that the Starship architecture for Artemis involves, depending upon how it's done, between 10 and 14 Starship launches to launch Starship to orbit, refuel it on orbit, get it to lunar orbit, refuel it in lunar orbit, then land it on the moon and come back. And that's because while Starship is potentially quite attractive as an Earth launch vehicle, it is extremely unattractive as an ascent vehicle for use on the moon or Mars because it's so heavy. It's 100 tons compared to the Apollo LEM ascent vehicle, which is 2 tons. You want something smaller. And what that smaller thing is something I call Starboat. Okay, Starboat, as I conceive it, would be something a lot like Starship, except much smaller, at least a factor of 5, perhaps a factor of 10 smaller in mass. So, which is, say, a factor of 2 to 3 smaller in linear dimensions. If for the lunar architecture, you would deliver Starship to lunar orbit, and you'd have a methane oxygen propelled Starboat that could go from orbit to surface and back, and Starship operating in lunar orbit as a tanker for it. That would be a vastly more effective Artemis architecture. Similarly, for Mars, okay, if you want to do direct return from the Martian surface with Starboat, and Starboat is scaled down by a factor of 5 compared to Starship, then instead of needing 600 tons of propellant, you'd need 120 tons of propellant, and you could do that with a 120 kilowatt reactor. Okay, if you use Starboat not to go from Mars surface to direct return, but to rendezvous with a Starship in Mars orbit, you only need 50 tons of propellant, and therefore you need 50 kilowatts of power to make that propellant, which is something within the range of extensions of the kind of technology that NASA is looking at now, tens of kilowatts per reactor. A couple of such reactors would get you to 50 kilowatts. Okay, so that's what is needed. Starship plus Starboat gives you both the Moon and Mars on a technical basis. Now, I've talked to Musk about Starboat personally, and he just says, oh, what do I need it? Show me, prove to me why I need it. I only want to develop one flight system. Well, it's not fine, but that's how it is. I believe that the National Lander Program needs to be repurposed. That is, the lander that is funded by NASA to support Artemis, which, unfortunately, given that they were already funding Starship, they should have insisted that that use a methane oxygen propulsion system to make it compatible with Starship. But since NASA's motivation for funding the National Lander was simply a concession to get Blue Origin and Lockheed Martin out of their hair because they were screaming about how they didn't get a contract, they just gave them a contract for whatever they wanted to do. Okay, I believe that I am acquainted with the management at Lockheed Martin, and I believe they would be quite happy with a multi-billion-dollar contract to make it methane oxygen. Some of the engineers might have been upset that their pet ideas were not adopted, but for management, money's money, and the that's the lander that we need. That's the correct architecture for Artemis. That is the correct architecture for Mars. Okay, now. That's technology. Now let's get back to this thing. Musk is right now claiming he's going to land an unmanned Starship on Mars, launched next year, and then a manned mission launched in 2028. That's nonsense, not going to happen. To launch a Starship to Mars requires not only attaining orbit, it requires developing the tanker Starships, developing the methods to do on-orbit refueling of the Starship, which would be at minimum at least 3 tankers, assuming it has a 100-ton delivery to orbit and the Starship only has a dry mass of 100 tons. If those targets deviate from that, more dry mass, less payload, you get to 4, 5, 6 tanker launches needed, and they all have to be done within the appropriate window. And then it has to do accurate interplanetary flight, reentry, and landing on Mars. Okay, that is not happening in the next 14 months, okay? Now, with tremendous drive and ambition, and Musk certainly has drive when he wants it and if he could focus on it, I believe it is possible to do that, to launch such a mission as a one-way unmanned mission in late 2028. Okay, now, however, the contents of that mission should not be a Tesla human mannequin robot. Okay, it was all fun to launch Starman in a Tesla thing when they were just using Falcon Heavy to show that it could throw something heavy on Transmars trajectory. Okay, it was cute. Okay, but if you're going to be able to land, forget 100 tons. Let's say Starship's real capability, Musk claims the Starship could land 100 tons on Mars. Let's say really it could land 30. That'd still be tremendous. That's 30 times what we can do now. What do you do with 30 tons landed on Mars? You send a robotic expedition to Mars. Okay, instead of landing one rover on Mars, you land 15, and you land 15 helicopters too, and not tiny little ones like Ingenuity, but much more substantial ones that can each carry, say, 50 kilograms of instruments. And so we go from the Sojourner-class helicopter to the Spirit and Opportunity-class helicopter. And they can fan out, and the rovers and helicopters can go all over the place, bring samples back to the Starship lander, and where you would have a well-instrumented static lab, and the samples can be brought in there and looked at, you know, by 12 different instruments or 50 instruments. And now you have all these different rovers and helicopters and the drillers and life detection experiments and all sorts of stuff deployed on Mars. You're talking about a Mars mission with at least, at a minimum, 100 times the punch, science punch, that the kind of robotic missions we've been able to do to date. And what you'd have with those 15 helicopters and 15 rovers and the other experiments is literally hundreds of science teams, because there's a science team associated with every instrument that's on a rover, okay, that'd be part of this mission. And therefore, you would get the overwhelming support of the science community for this mission. And not just because you're giving people money, okay, but because you're actually producing terrific science, okay? And that would get the public support for this mission. And that's what would make this mission and this program something that would have enduring both scientific community and widespread public and political support, okay? Because people would be able to see that this is not being done as the whim of an eccentric businessman, but something which is truly grand, something truly worthy of what it is doing. And people would see in general that this heavy lift capability, low cost heavy lift capability that Starship represents enormous opportunities for science, for much bigger space telescopes and all the rest of that. But if you're going to do that, okay, if we're going to send a robotic expedition to Mars in 2028, you can't be cutting the Mars program now. In fact, you need to be expanding it, because the development of all those rovers and helicopters and the instruments for them and all the rest of that, okay, costs money. So if this is incoherent, what is going on? We should be planning robotic science expeditions using Starship. Okay, 2028, some people may say that's ambitious. Well, in that case, it could be launched in 2031, and that's certainly possible. That this needs to be a coherent strategy where we take the imminent arrival of heavy lift and heavy Mars payload delivery, and we say we're going to exploit this by developing the robotic instruments, that is the actual rovers and helicopters, as well the scientific instruments that go on them, to have a grand scientific campaign on Mars. And then if the Planetary Protection Program people should come up and say, but wait a second, you didn't sterilize the Starship on orbit. They say, go away. Okay. All right. Whereas if it's something that you don't want to happen, you say, hey, that sounds like a good reason to cancel the launch. And that's where this is. Okay. That's where this is. So this is how we get the nation behind it. This is how we get tremendous science out of this program for real. And of course, yes, this prepares the way for humans to Mars, conceivably in 2033, which, by the way, is an excellent launch year, and which I do not believe is unfeasible if we adopt this approach. That's 8 years from now. We went from Kennedy's speech to landing on the moon in 8 years, and frankly, from a technical point of view, we are far better prepared today to execute this program than they were to send people to the moon in 1961. We had 15 minutes of human spaceflight experience. We didn't even know if people could eat in space. Okay, this is how this can be done. This is how it should be done, and this is how it must be done. Thank you.
Robert Zubrin of the Mars Society, speaking on May the 28th this year. Now, Zubrin has been our guest here on The Space Show 19 times between the years 2000 and 2021. You can listen at our website, which is space.southernfm.com.au. Then click on the alphabetical list of people, link, then Z for Zubrin. And just time to mention that there is a new Aussie satellite in space. It's from Gilmour Space Company in Queensland, launched by the SpaceX company. And there's other satellites as well with Australian components on it now in orbit. Well, you've been listening to The Space Show. I'm Andrew Rennie. On our Mission Control panel, we have Richard. And we'll be back next week in a new studio. So, farewell, Parliament Street. We thank thee.